Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern. Ich darf Sie begrüßen zu einer weiteren Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt. That means always in a good mood. This is what I just said in German. That's the credo of our program here. We are not in the depressive mode, you know, we are not like in a melancholic kind of state of mind. We always try to be cheerful and optimistic. You could say in the Anglo-Saxon basically style. Ich werde dann nachher wieder auf Englisch wechseln zu unserem distinguished guest heute in der Sendung. Ich bin hier nach wie vor an dieser sehr interessanten Konferenz in Shanghai, in einer Art Halle des Volkes, in some kind of Hall of the People, in einem sehr großen Bankettsaal. Es finden jetzt überall Diskussionen statt, Panelrunden, wo wir uns unterhalten über Fragen der globalen Sicherheit, der Seidenstraße, natürlich auch der globalen Zusammenarbeit. Ökologie ist ein Riesenthema hier in Shanghai. Und wie ich Ihnen schon ein paar Mal gesagt habe, wir haben eine sehr internationale Gruppe von Politikern, auch ehemaligen Politikern hier. Und das macht es eben interessant, einmal auf engstem Raum, vielleicht wie an einem World Economic Forum in Davos, unterschiedlichste Persönlichkeiten treffen kann. Wir haben bis jetzt, und ich bin da inbegriffen, sehr beeindruckt über die Errungenschaften von China gesprochen. Wir sind alle sozusagen begeistert und wir bewundern, was die Chinesen machen. Aber man kann es natürlich auch ein bisschen kritischer sehen. Und ich freue mich jetzt auf dieses Gespräch mit einem australischen Politiker. Und wir haben schon abgemacht, ein bisschen constructive criticism is now desperately needed in this wave of enthusiasm. Ich möchte ganz herzlich begrüßen den Herrn Grant Chapman. Grant Chapman ist ein früheres Mitglied des australischen Parlaments, sowohl in der großen Kammer wie auch in der kleinen Kammer. Und wie er mir gesagt hat, vor allem auch spezialisiert auf Finanzfragen, auf Bankfragen, hat auch das Beziehungen zur Schweiz, kennt unser Land in diesem Zusammenhang selbstverständlich. And now it's my great privilege to host you in our program. Thank you very much for talking to us. It's interesting. Welcome to Weltwoche Daily.
Thanks, Roger. It's a great privilege to share some time with you and have a chat about what we've experienced here and perhaps some of the background.
let me just start with that. Would be my first question. I mean, you are from Australia. The Australians have a long-standing relationship with China. You've probably been to China many times. What is your most important takeaway from these days in Beijing and in Shanghai? What's the most striking observation of the moment? What's the most interesting thing about China at the moment?
Well, I think it reinforces to me the need for us to engage with China constructively. Obviously, there's a lot to admire about what they've achieved over the last 40, 45 years in terms of economic development and growth, and taking a substantial number of their population out of poverty. But I think we also need to know, be aware of the frictions and the potential expansionist attitude of the current leadership group in China.
Where do you see the risks? Where are the concerns?
Well, I'm involved in giving a talk, as you are, on democracy. Mm-hmm. And I think that China is yet to embrace a fully democratic system, as we're aware. And I think there's certainly resistance to that among the leadership, as I observe it. Certainly they've freed up economically. In economic terms, they've effectively abandoned communism. They don't have a full market system. It's still a centrally directed economy, but there's a strong element of free enterprise, private enterprise in the economy. But the traditional link between that and general freedoms, which is essential for democracy, I don't think has been fully developed, I say fully developed, is not accepted by the leadership. So that can then lead to adventurism. I mean, if there are problems domestically, if you've got an all-powerful leader, they can try and focus externally with military activity or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that we need to be wary of. I'm particularly concerned about the belligerent attitude to Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And if you talk about miracles, I mean, Taiwan is probably just as good an economic miracle as China in the mm-hmm. way it developed, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With a much greater degree of freedom. It started, I suppose, as an autocracy mm-hmm. as well, mm-hmm. but it mm-hmm. developed democratic institutions which haven't yet been developed in China. So, you know, one of the Chinese arguments is, well, we wouldn't have achieved what we've achieved mm-hmm. If we had a fully democratic system, but mm-hmm. Taiwan's done it.
Yeah.
So I think it's the Chinese ingenuity that's yeah. contributed to their economic growth and development yeah. rather than the system.
Yeah. It's very hard for a Swiss to understand China because the country is so big. It has a history which is totally different from our country. As far as I've learned, China went through hell in the 20th century, even in some parts of the 19th century. They're somehow stability-oriented or stability-obsessed. On the other hand, they have an amazingly dynamic economical system. I cannot figure out how this coexists, you know? A one-party governance, a one-party system with this kind of market-oriented economy. And it seems to be a market-oriented economy. Otherwise, they would not have been able to raise this Shanghai to this kind of skyrocketing heights. Have you any notion? Do you see how China works as a political system? How does it? How do they cope with everything?
Well, yesterday in the briefing we had at the Shanghai People's Congress, they explained to us that they have a consultative system, like a tiered system, almost a pyramid, I guess, mm-hmm. of power, which they claim allows the general population to provide input to policies and processes. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit sceptical about that. I think it's more of a top-down command system, mm-hmm. Whereas we have Switzerland, Australia, UK, Western Europe has more of a bottoms-up system in terms of how our governance works. Mm-hmm. But there would have to be some element of consultation, some mm-hmm. element of bringing the people with them mm-hmm. for them to accept it. Yeah. I mean, you go back to 1989, we saw the Tiananmen Square situation. So obviously at that point there were a group, particularly of students and mm-hmm. others, who weren't satisfied with the... Mm-hmm. with the progress that had been made towards a democratic mm-hmm. structure there. And that followed on from the economic growth. The economic mm-hmm. growth had started to develop there. They were getting much stronger economically, yeah. more wealthy, but they wanted the freedoms, the yeah. other freedoms that we enjoy, that went with that. But that was, you know, stamped out very quickly with the tanks. Yeah. You know, yeah. And I guess that's the ultimate sanction they still have with the PLA still have the authority.
Yeah. And how do you see the current leadership, Xi Jinping?
Well, I mean, in a sense, although I've had a number of visits to China, you're still observing it in a sense from a distance. But I know a number of the Australian journalists that have worked here that I've spoken with. They say that under Xi, that there is a lot more suppression of liberties than there were, perhaps, say, under Deng Xiaoping and his immediate successors.
It's the For me, the question is, if I try to put myself into the footsteps of a Chinese leader, the dilemma for Xi Jinping must be that how much party control you can adapt without strangulating the economy, which of course would hit him, which could cause a huge uproar in the country.
That's right.
Because if they can't deliver, then they lose the support of the people.
And that's what you wonder now. I mean, there's obviously some element of slowing of the economic growth rate, mm-hmm. and we get to
Are
see
you
what
pessimistic the there, or do you think they're really on some kind of a downturn, or is it?
Well, I think they're on a downturn. It's a matter of whether it's a temporary downturn, and mm-hmm. then there'll be a revitalization, or whether, it's a continuing slide. I mean, I suppose if you look at economics around the world, the history of economics, you have downturns and generally you recover from them, but that's in a traditional Western system. Whether China with a command system, if it got onto a downturn, has the capacity then to mm-hmm. to reverse that remains mm-hmm. to be seen. I guess I'm probably in no position to judge.
In Europe, for example, I guess, I don't know how it is in the Australian media, American media, there is a growing concern, the growing criticism about China. China is seen as a autocracy, as a threat to the to the West. I had a conversation recently with the investor Peter Thiel, and he's also a bit of a China hawk. One can argue. What are your observations from Australia? I mean, is China a partner of the West, which is how China displays and presents itself here in our conference, or is China a potential aggressor or a potential enemy of the West?
I think their aim would be long-term economic dominance. Mm-hmm. Whether then that encompasses military domination, military conquest of other countries, I'm not convinced of that. I think that they've probably got certainly Taiwan as a target. Mm-hmm. Whether they would then, if they achieve success there, would want to go into countries that traditionally they can't claim have been part of China. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't see that as a threat, but certainly I see them, if they control the world economy, then there could be dangers to our economic well-being down the track. I mean, Australia certainly has suffered at their hands in recent years simply because we raised the question of the origin of the coronavirus. We were the ones that said there should be an independent investigation of how this came about. Was it just the monkeys in the market, or was the experiments going on? Germ warfare experiments that got away from them.
And what was the conclusion? What's the consensus now in Australia?
I think we suspect that it was experimentation that got away. But as a result of us raising that and saying that we had a free trade agreement, they just slapped tariffs on our barley, on our lobsters, on our wine. Out of the blue, as punishment for questioning.
How is Australia reacting to these tensions? I'm reading, I'm learning that you're also building up your military at the moment. What's the development there?
Well, we've developed this AUKUS arrangement, which is Australia, UK, United States, a new defence arrangement. The key part of that for Australia is that we will be acquiring nuclear submarines, which we've only had conventional submarines in the past. Mm-hmm. So that will enhance our defensive capacity, although it's a 10, 20, 30-year project to get delivery of those submarines. But we see that three-way alliance, as it were, as very important to our own security. Mm-hmm. And also there's the Four Eyes group, Five Eyes group, isn't it, which also involves Canada and India regular defence security consultation.
So there is a growing concern in Australia that the tensions and even some kind of military confrontation is looming somehow in this region. Are you severely concerned, or would you say it's a precautionary arrangement?
I think at this stage it's precautionary. I mean, the hope is, and as we see, it would be the Taiwanese situation that would trigger that, and we're just hopeful that common sense would prevail. I mean, my view is certainly historically Taiwan was part of China, but it's also been parts of Japan, under Japanese rule at various stages. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's now, what is it now, 70 years effectively that they've been independent of mainland China. Mm-hmm. I think they're entitled to determine their own future, and I certainly wouldn't succumb to the view that China has a right to take over Taiwan.
If Xi Jinping would hire you as his consultant and say, well, we need some constructive criticism from a country which is close by, but not so close by, you're also flying, you told me, 11 hours here from Shanghai. It's like to go back to fly to Switzerland.
But at least we're in a similar time zone.
Yeah, the river zone. That makes the difference. That makes the difference. But what would be your constructive recommendation if you would say, well, China is a country with so fascinating potential, fascinating achievements. It has a traumatizing history behind it. It could somehow get over it. So what have the Chinese to consider to realize their goals, which they declare as being, peaceful coexistence, cooperation? What would your suggestion be?
I would say pursue policies that actually give that substance. Mm-hmm. Actually pursue your economic development. You've got wonderful achievements in that field, your economic development, your industry development, your technology. Pursue that. Pull back from your military adventurism, because We want a peaceful world, and everyone benefits mm-hmm. from a peaceful world where we mm-hmm. can focus on mm-hmm. our constructive mm-hmm. economic activities, mm-hmm. not be focused on military activities, mm-hmm. And don't, because of the tension and the fear that that creates, because of the great economic strength and military strength of China, mm-hmm. even if they see it as defensive, mm-hmm. the rest of the world sees it as aggressive because mm-hmm. of the military potential that China has and its size. So that would be the first thing I would say. Let's focus on trade, friendship, development, sensible cooperation. And also, my second advice would be, and I understand how they might find this difficult, but over time, move towards a more democratic system. Yeah. However they describe their current system of democracy, move to a more democratic system mm-hmm. where you can have a multi-party electoral system and you don't have to be a member of the Communist Party to get on in this country.
This is also a question I always have. I try to figure out a country that has been torn apart by civil war. There were wars in China in the 15th, 16th century where it was falling apart. How can you bring a one-party system to open up? In Switzerland, for example, in the 19th century, we already had our new constitution, but no direct democracy. And it was like the parliamentarians thought, it's enough if we have the power, we don't need direct democracy. But one day in a city near Zurich, there was a new party formed, the Democratic Party, and they fought for direct democracy. Mm. And at the end, but not voluntarily, the elite gave in.
I suppose in Australia we don't have direct democracy. We have representative democracy. We do have a system of referenda that if they want to change the constitution, there has to be a referendum.
Okay.
And if a government can put up proposals for plebiscite or referendum if they want to, in essence, in Australia, representative democracy, you elect a government to govern. Mm-hmm. They do have the restraint on them of a Senate, which the government often doesn't have mm-hmm. a majority mm-hmm. in the Senate, so they have to negotiate mm-hmm. legislation through. Mm-hmm. But so we don't have the same direct democracy where things can regularly go to mm-hmm. referendum mm-hmm. as they do in Switzerland. But it works. I mean, basically, I suppose the principle in Australia is you elect the rascals for 3 years, and if you don't like what they do, you throw them out and put someone else in.
This we would never understand in Switzerland, because we say we elect the rascals for 4 years, but we don't let them in peace, because with initiatives and referendum we can control them all over the time. So we would suggest to Australia, actually to everybody in the world, adapt some Swiss direct democracy. This is the best system world.
I think it possibly is. I mean,
but probably it doesn't only work for it. It doesn't only work for Switzerland. You know?
From time to time, it's been considered in Australia, but it's never come to
the elite
to fruition.
The elite didn't give in. Right. Not yet. A final view on the United States of America, which is also a mesmerizing country, full of surprises, full of mood swings in politics. What's your take on the United States of America? Who will win, and what would it mean for the world? The outcome of the American election. How important are these elections at this crucial moment of time in the world?
I think it's a crucial election. My personal view is that from a policy perspective, I prefer Trump, mm-hmm. but some of his personal idiosyncrasies repel me. I think it's a 50-50. 50-50 at the moment as to who will win.
And what would you say is the difference? I mean, if a Kamala Harris would be elected, if a Trump would be elected, what would that mean for the world?
I think America, in terms of security and defence, international security, America will be stronger under mm-hmm. Trump. To the extent that I've had exposure to what Kamala Harris is and does, I don't, and from the Biden administration, I don't think that America would be as strong in terms of security, and the world be as strong in terms of security under her leadership. So
that would mean, one can argue when Trump was president, we didn't have these crazy wars in the Ukraine and in other places. As soon as Joe Biden entered the office,
that's right,
hell broke loose somehow.
Because
somehow.
I think they, you know, those that wanted that to pursue, you know, military goals saw, well, he's not as strong as.
Probably, even the Russian President Putin, who would not—I mean, that was Trump was saying all the time—he would not have dared to enter Ukraine. We don't know because with Trump, we never know. Yeah. Is it narcissism or is it really? It's what his name
is. Exactly right.
I mean, one final point in our conversation, and we have huge migration problems in Europe at the moment. This is the big topic in politics. This is the, you could say, the defining line between the establishment and between the so-called populist parties, which are becoming increasingly popular. So Australia has a lot of experience with migration, illegal migration. As I've learned, you've actually done a very, very good job. You somehow managed to get it all under control. What can Europe, what can Switzerland, Germany, France, what can we learn from Australia? What are the pillars of your migration and asylum policy?
Well, we the essence of it is that we have a migration policy that focuses on skills, or family reunion, or refugees, and we set a quota of refugees, and it's per capita, it's a very generous quota. So once that's filled, then that, unless there's some particular outbreak of an issue in a world where there needs to be something's done urgently. So, and with those family reunions, if people already have a son or a daughter living there, and they want to join them, they can come. And then we focus, we have basically a point system for the person to meet in terms of their education, their work experience, and if that fits in with a need in our economy for a particular skill, then they can come. And we enforce that quite rigidly. And I suppose we're fortunate in that we're a continent surrounded by water, it's a bit easier to protect our borders, although even, as you're aware, we've had these illegal arrivals, we've set up a processing system offshore. If you arrive illegally without a visa, you're shunted off there, and then your claim, if you're claiming to be a refugee, your claim for refugee status is closely looked at. Interestingly, the current government has come under criticism from my side, the current Liberal opposition, and I think widespread community concern, taking supposed refugees in from the Gazan situation without doing proper security checks on their background. And that's become a real negative issue for the current government.
In Europe, they say, well, if an illegal migrant is coming, we would like to push him back or to bring him back to his country of origin, but this is not possible. They're not accepting them, they're destroying their papers at the border. Any suggestion how to cope with that?
Well, we've been able to do so. I mean, if they don't have their papers, then they're an illegal migrant, and they go to the processing centre, and that's offshore, and then our officials do detail. I mean, even without their papers, they'll do a detailed investigation of their background. Very, very few of them, make the grade.
Okay.
And so it's over the last decade, I guess, It's acted as a fairly strong deterrent for people even trying to come in illegally, because they know that they're not going to.
And social welfare, you have rather low standards for migrants coming in. I mean, you have incentives that they go into the labour market, etc.
No, if they're accepted as a temporary protection visa, they're entitled to the full social security benefits.
Okay. But you do a more, I mean, you're filtering more thoroughly.
Filtering thoroughly.
If you look at the news in Europe, if you look at the situation in Europe, as far as you understand, as far as you see it, what's the biggest mistake our governments do, according to you, from an Australian perspective, in migration policy?
I think that they didn't. Let's go back a step. I mentioned we have quotas for refugees. Mm-hmm. We also have an overall quota for the number of migrants we'll allow in any one year.
Okay, all right.
And I think probably the biggest mistake Europe made was they didn't just set quotas. And
no quota.
From what I understand, they didn't.
No limit.
So if you set the numbers, once the numbers achieved, well, you've got to wait till next year. Even if you've got a, you know, the skill or whatever to come in. And again, the current government has got a bit lax on that as well. And the number of migrants in the last 12 months, I think, was 500,000, and that's way over. So they've sort of relaxed the quota. And again, the general population said, no, that's not Australia. We're not.
In Europe, it's also a bad factor is the whole ideologization of the debate. You know, people say, well, we are for legal migration, but against illegal migration, they are suddenly labeled as racists, and you cannot openly discuss it. Everybody has to defend himself morally. Did you have the same situation in Australia, or was it? Are you more pragmatic in that sense?
I think. There is a segment of the people in Australia, I'd call them more to the left of politics, mm-hmm. who would use that argument. Mm-hmm. But the overwhelming majority of Australians are not racist, mm-hmm. But they recognise that Australia can't have an open door policy. Okay. You know, we've got to sustain our continent. We are the driest, one of the driest places in the world. We can't have an unlimited population. Okay. So we've got to manage the growth of our population by natural growth and migration to make sure that our lifestyle is sustainable, and people understand that and are in favour of that.
So the existential dimension creates some kind of underlying consensus. Mm. Last question, Grant. We are at this conference here. We were talking about critical issues in this conversation, about tensions, etc., etc., migration. What's the beam of light, the silver lining that you take out from your visit now in China? Is there something you have observed which creates a sense of optimism, of positive, future-oriented, optimistic thinking?
Well, I think, to some extent, I think this conference indicates there is a willingness for the Chinese to engage mm-hmm. person to person. And one of the things I've said is that the best way to achieve peace, I think, is for politicians to get to know each other at a personal level, not just deal at the institutional level, but build personal relationships. Mm-hmm. And then you can go to them and at least put your point of view and hopefully have some influence mm-hmm. For good mm-hmm. in doing that, rather than just dealing at an institutional mm-hmm. sort of... policy level. So I think that one of the good things that I've noticed, or I'm encouraged by out of mm-hmm. this week, is that at least through this process they are engaging. Now it's a matter of how much they are listening and how much they're trying to convince us that everything's mm-hmm. rosy mm-hmm. in their garden. Mm-hmm. And you've got to, I'm still not
but at least
but
at least we are talking.
And that's the main thing.
And this is, of course, the most important thing. This is, by the way, meine Damen und Herren, the most important thing in civilization. It's the power of conversation. Dear Grant, many thanks,
Roger,
for this conversation. It was great talking
and nice
to some Australian common sense here.
It's nice to meet another great Roger from Switzerland.
But
and also my brother-in-law is a Roger. So
great. So the Rogers of the world unite.
And he was the Deputy Premier in South Australia.
Many years ago. So even Roger Federer has room to improve. Yeah. Okay. Also, meine Damen und Herren, ich danke Ihnen ganz herzlich. Das war's hier noch einmal aus Shanghai. Wir melden uns zurück und wünschen Ihnen einen schönen Tag.